There's never been a December when evil was turned off for a month. War, disease, racism, and all the rest continue. Nevertheless, during this time of year, slowly and surely, I get sentimental, I get hopeful, and I get nostalgic. Now, the evergreen tree has always been an important transitional object for me during Christmas. As a child, each Christmas, my father would buy a small tree that was still in a bucket of earth, and he would give it to me as a gift to keep in my room and decorate. I learned later when I got older that he did this to keep me from messing with the tree in the main room. But still, it was a tradition I appreciated. After Christmas each year, we would go out into the yard and plant this tree. And amazingly enough, this was over 50 years ago, and many years later, three of those trees from my childhood are still growing on that lot. There's one of them. Like a teddy bear or a blanket, the tree helped me transition from summer to winter, and from childhood to adulthood. Well, when did this tradition of bringing a tree into the house at Christmas begin? Many accounts trace the start of the Christmas tree back to pre-Christian times, when Romans used evergreens as symbols of fertility and regeneration to decorate their houses. However, there is no actual documentation that links this Roman practice to the modern Christmas tree. References to this Roman practice may be due more to our desire to see our Christmas customs rooted in ancient pagan traditions than to actual fact. The modern Christmas tree began as a custom that at first was limited to a single place, the German-speaking town of Strasbourg. The tradition of Christmas trees appears to have developed in Strasbourg around the beginning of the 17th century. The ritual only spread to other parts of Germany after 1750. And a key date in this development may have been in 1771, when a young writer, Goethe, made an extensive visit to Strasbourg. Goethe then included a Christmas tree in a dramatic moment in a 1774 novel that established his literary reputation. Because of Goethe and his literary colleagues, the Christmas tree spread to other parts of Germany. And by the 1830s, German Protestants had taken the tree as an emblem of their faith. German Catholics adopted the Holy Manger as their Christmas icon. Protestants have stories that explain the custom's origin. One story attributes the invention of the Christmas tree to Martin Luther. While walking in the German woods one Christmas Eve, Luther felt particularly inspired by God's majesty. He hoped to convey this experience to his children, so he returned home with an evergreen that he decked with candles representing the stars of heaven. It's a lovely story, but it's not true. Various sources describe how the Christmas tree came to America. One legend says that during the American Revolution, Hessian soldiers brought the first Christmas trees to our country. There's no documentation that supports this claim. During our American Revolution, Christmas trees had not yet become widespread in Germany, making the Hessian story unlikely. We do have evidence in the form of an undated drawing, a drawing done sometime between 1812 and 1820, that German immigrants set up trees in Pennsylvania about 200 years ago. Now, Unitarian Universalists, we like to say that a Unitarian minister brought the first Christmas tree to America. This is a slight exaggeration on our part, because the story occurs at least 15 years after German immigrants in Pennsylvania set up trees. Nevertheless, it was one of the first. And because it is a story about a Unitarian minister, I want to tell it this morning. Karl Fallon was a descendant of the German elite, the son of a respected judge. But early in his life, Fallon became a young revolutionary. He was a representative of the emerging liberal nationalist movement in Germany. As a university student, Fallon wrote an explosive political song. The police arrested him and charged him with complicity in a political murder. The court trial acquitted him. He was then appointed as a member of the faculty of a German university in 1820 at the age of 24. But he continued his radical political activities. And to avoid arrest in Germany, he went into exile in Switzerland, where he got another teaching position. But 4 years later, authorities in Switzerland compelled him to flee again in face of new charges that he had organized a revolutionary cell. This time, Fallon found home in America. He arrived in New York having learned English during the voyage. He carried letters of introduction from the aged Lafayette, and he tried to find employment in the Boston area. Fallon changed his name from the German Karl to the English Charles and moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts. There he married Eliza Cabot. He formed close ties with the liberal Unitarian establishment that dominated Harvard and Boston, and he found Unitarianism wholly compatible with his own progressive Christian beliefs. In 1830, 5 years after he arrived in America, Fallon became an ordained Unitarian minister. Harvard appointed him to a full-time faculty position. A group of his admirers had provided 5 years of funding for a new professorship of German literature. They expected Harvard would pick up the cost of Fallon's salary after that. Fallon's son was born in 1830, and the next year the family moved into a new house. But within less than 5 years, the radical commitments that had brought him to America in the first place brought him down again. This time the issue was slavery. Fallon quickly sensed the parallels between the anti-slavery movement and the principles that he had stood for in Germany. He helped organize a Cambridge anti-slavery society based at Harvard. Radical abolition of slavery did not sit well with the Boston Unitarian establishment. There was many financial interests that represented Unitarians involved in the slave trade, and they did not want major changes. Most of Fallon's acquaintances regarded William Lord Garrison as a crazy man. They warned Charles Fallon that becoming an active abolitionist would surely jeopardize his professional career. In early 1835, Fallon learned that his appointment at Harvard would end at the end of the spring semester. They weren't going to fund this radical. He and his family, his son had just turned 5 that year, would be left with no source of income. Eliza Fallon may have been born into the prominent New England Cabot family, but she had few financial resources of her own, and the family did not come to her assistance. But Fallon's remaining admirers rescued him. They arranged for him to have what was an ideal position. He would oversee the education of two children of a wealthy Boston merchant. James Perkins had recently died, and Mrs. Perkins was deeply in grief. She needed help caring for her children. In return for this part-time work, Fallon was to have the use of the Perkins house to be able to live there, and the family would pay him the comfortable annual salary of $2,000 a year. Well, Fallon's radicalism also extended to his opinions about how to raise children. Fallon believed children were born perfect creatures, and that education should consist in cultivating these attributes that were already present in the young souls. He wrote that he intended to study the boys' natures, to awaken every dormant energy that the two boys already possessed. He dealt with the two boys by imposing only such rules as their own moral sense approved. Fallon shared a real sympathy with all the boys' concerns and wants, and a hearty desire to gratify all their legitimate and innocent desires. The Perkins family fired Fallon in December of 1835. Even liberal Unitarians found Fallon's ideas about teaching too indulgent. About this time, in November of 1835, a woman named Harriet Martineau came to visit. Born in 1802, Harriet Martineau was a prominent English Unitarian intellectual. She was visiting the United States to write a book about our country. She met and quickly befriended Charles Fallon. Fallon told her that if she really wanted to understand the central moral issue facing America in 1835, she should attend an abolitionist meeting. Following his advice, she attended an abolitionist women's meeting held in Boston on November 19th, 1835. She came to this meeting in the role of a reporter. However, during the meeting, someone passed a note to Martineau asking her to express her opinion as a visiting person from England, to express her opinion of what she had heard at the anti-slavery meeting. On the one hand, she agreed with the abolitionist principles. On the other hand, she knew that making a public gesture of solidarity with them would alienate her from most of her American acquaintances. This would cut off her access to most of the contacts who were her sources for the book on America that she was writing. Later she wrote, "I foresaw that almost every house in Boston, except those of the abolitionists, would be shut against me, that my relation to the country would be completely changed, as I should suddenly be transformed from being a guest and an observer to being considered a missionary or a spy." Later she said about the note asking her to speak, "The moment of reading this note was one of the most painful of my life. Taking a public stand is scary." Yet in spite of her fears, she rose and expressed her opposition to slavery. Boston newspapers reported and ridiculed the English woman's support of the abolitionists. Newspapers quickly reprinted those reports throughout the United States. 6 weeks later, Harriet Martineau went to spend New Year's Eve with her friend Charles Fallon, who had gotten her into this. And both of them at that time were under heavy pressure. Martineau had just lost her social credibility, and Charles Fallon had just lost his post as tutor to the Perkins children, although the Perkins family were allowing him to spend Christmas in their home. When Martineau arrived at Fallon's home December 31st, 1835, Charles and his wife were just attaching candles to a tree. The Fallons had postponed this ritual until New Year's Eve to adapt to Martineau's schedule. They had placed the tree in the front drawing room of the house. A toy hung from every branch. As Fallon's son, 5-year-old Charlie, and his two older companions arrived home, the adults, before Charlie and his friends could see it, the adults closed the door to the front drawing room. They moved into an adjacent room where, as Martineau put it, they sat around trying to look as if nothing was going to happen. After they served the visitors tea and coffee, they played a round of parlor games. The goal was to distract the children's attention from the front drawing room, where Charlie's parents were now busily lighting the candles. Finally, they threw open the double doors, and the children rushed in. And they saw a magnificent tree on a table about this height with candles and candy placed on it. Now, compared with the 6-foot trees of today, the 1835 tree was small enough to put on a table. Martineau wrote, "Their faces were upturned to the blaze, all eyes wide open, all lips parted, all steps arrested. Nobody spoke. Only Charlie leaped for joy." After a few moments, the children discovered that the tree had something edible on it, and the babble began again. The adults told the children to take what they could from the tree without burning themselves on the candles. Martineau said, "We tall people kept watch and helped them with good things from the higher branches." After the children had eaten their fill of collectibles, the evening continued with dancing and mugs of steaming mull wine. By 11, all the other guests had gone home. Charlie was in bed, and Harriet Martineau herself was left alone with the boy's parents. The tree was a success, a time of joy for the grown-ups and for 5-year-old Charles and his friends, the Perkins children. The whole event had taken place in the Perkins house where the Fallons were still living. It had been a delightful evening, and Martineau concluded her account, her description of this evening, by predicting that the Christmas tree ritual would become an established American tradition. Martineau would always recall her American sojourn as a profoundly transforming episode in her life. Because of Charles Fallon, she had transferred herself from a journalist into a political activist. Fallon, as her very nearest friend, guide, and guardian, was someone that she kept a picture of to the end of her life. She kept a portrait next to one of William Lord Garrison in her parlor. Well, as for Charles Fallon, he went on to serve as minister of a new Unitarian church in Lexington, Massachusetts. In keeping with his radical approach to everything, he insisted that the congregation construct its sanctuary in the shape of a circle. The circle was to show the equality of the lay members of the congregation with the minister. The minister is not better than you. We're all equal. We're in the round together. Now, it turned out that the cost of a round building was beyond the means of the new congregation. Instead, they built an 8-sided sanctuary, and this became the first sort of round worship space in America. This 8-sided Unitarian church, now called Fallon Church, still exists in Lexington, Massachusetts. In January of 1840, Reverend Fallon died in a shipboard fire while on his way from New York to Boston. He was 44 years old. Now, I suspect that if Reverend Fallon were here today, he would congratulate us on the progress we have made. We have ended slavery, and we have recently elected a president of color to lead our country. I suspect he would also agree with us that we have much work to do in achieving equality for all people, much work still to do. In 1838, Harriet Martineau published her account of the Fallon's Christmas tree. It was widely read in England and the United States. And soon Americans started to bring trees into their homes that stretched from floor to ceiling. They decorated the trees with candles, with toys, with candies. In the ancient tradition of religious offerings to the gods, families sacrificed an evergreen tree and transformed it into a shrine. The first electric lights replaced candles in 1882, and by 1895, electric lights replaced candles on the White House Christmas tree. By 1900, one in five American homes had a Christmas tree, 20% of homes. In Reading, Pennsylvania, 100 years ago, it was fashionable for people to decorate trees with stuffed animals. Squirrels and chipmunks perched on the branches of the Christmas trees. Grouped around the base were possums, raccoons, and occasionally a fox. Many households created elaborate landscapes beneath the trees, including earthen hills 3 to 5 feet tall, covered with snow or moss. One house had a mountain in its front room, achieved with an estimated half ton of rocks. While most people did not adopt this approach in decorating, by 1930, Christmas trees were nearly universal in homes in America. This year, farmers will sell 40 million live Christmas trees from lots across the United States. Unlike artificial trees that come from Asia, live trees are grown in American farms right here in our country. Unlike artificial trees, live trees convert greenhouse gases into oxygen. Unlike artificial trees that do not rot, live trees are biodegradable. No material possession lasts forever. Our childhood teddy bears and blankets eventually fall apart, and the sacred tree comes down after Christmas. Nevertheless, the tree can be a transitional object. Like a teddy bear that helps children transition at night from being awake to being asleep, a Christmas tree helps us transition from summer to winter, from the old year to the new year, from living in the cold north to living in Florida, and from the past to the present. Today, few people remember Charles Fallon's name. Nevertheless, each Christmas, when I see Christmas trees everywhere, and I saw them last week in the Tampa airport, they had one that was about 25 feet tall, and in Washington National Airport, they had another one that was about 25 feet tall. They're everywhere, in shopping malls and in homes. When I see them, I think about the life and the beliefs of Charles Fallon. Now, others have other associations when they see a Christmas tree, but when I see a tree, I remember the Unitarian minister and his beliefs in the dignity of all human beings.